Seeing the woman, if any of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. And at this they go away. And then Jesus straightens up and asks her, Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir, she said. Then neither do I condemn you, Jesus declared. Go now and leave your life of sin. Neither do I condemn you. Go and leave your life of sin. Go and sin no more. Now, the ministry of Jesus was full of incidents of people who came to him. In the case of this woman, she was brought to him. Jerusalem was absolutely packed with people because it was one of the great pilgrimage feasts of the Jewish year, the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths. And it was a feast which remembered the many years during which the Israelites had been in the wilderness, the 40 years, as they waited to enter the promised land. And the people remembered how God had provided for his people in the wilderness. And some of them would build temporary shelters out of branches and leaves. They were booths, tabernacles. And they would spend the period of the feast living in these booths. Others would be staying in the city. It was a time when there was light day and night in the city, remembering how God had been with his people in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. It was a time of the harvest. It was a time of joy. It was a time of celebration. The people were full of thankfulness to God. And yet, at this particular feast, there was also something of a shadow hanging over Jesus. He didn't come immediately to the feast. If you read in chapter 7, you see that he delayed his coming. Because those who were his enemies, those who were seeking to destroy him, were trying to have him arrested. That is why we read at the end of chapter 7 how those who'd been sent to arrest him came back. And they were asked, why didn't you bring him in? And their answer was this: no man ever spoke the way this man does. Jesus was teaching the people. And those who went to arrest him listened to him. Earlier on in this gospel, Jesus said to his disciples, when some of those who were following him began to go back, will you also go away? And his disciples said, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. And so no one ever spoke the way this man did. In fact, if you have a Bible which shows the words of Jesus in red print, you'll see how little he said in what was a very complex situation that was presented to him when the woman was brought and made to stand before him. He spoke with authority, we're told, and not like the teachers of the law. And so there's opposition, there's hatred, there's antagonism, but that's what lies behind the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, the same group we were looking at this morning in Luke 15, as they brought this woman to him who had been caught in the act of adultery. It's probable that she had gone up to the feast, and there she had met someone she knew who was not her husband. And because of the nature of the feast and the unusual circumstances of it, as night fell, they spent that night together. And in the morning, these men had come and broken in upon them and then brought her into the temple and into the presence of Jesus. They're not really interested in her. She's a test case. They're really trying to find a reason to accuse Jesus. What is he going to say? Is he going to say, well, no, this woman shouldn't be stoned? In which case they'll say, well, he is contradicting the teaching of Moses. Or will he say, yes, she should be put to death? In which case they'll go and tell the Romans that he is advocating capital punishment, which they had no authority to do. And so they're really presenting him with a test question, a test case, in which they're pretty certain they will catch him whatever he says. And yet, once again, Jesus shows his amazing authority as he challenges them and says, if any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. So it's a tense situation. It's a situation of antagonism and hatred to Jesus. And it's lived out, it's worked out before a great crowd of people who have gathered to listen to him teaching in the temple. And it also concerns a woman, a needy woman. And Jesus, in the way that he handles the whole situation, is aware, he's mindful of it all. And I want us really just to look at the passage really in three ways. First of all, to look at the men who brought the woman, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. They were deeply religious men. The teachers of the law were those who understood the Old Testament, and they taught the people from the Old Testament. They were experts in the law, particularly the first five books of the Old Testament, the books of Moses. And then the Pharisees, they were a very righteous group in the sense that they kept lots and lots of laws, hundreds of laws. They were the separated ones. That's what their word, that their name meant. And they prided themselves on the fact that they were very strict in their religious observances. And so as the teachers of the law and the Pharisees come in with this woman, all the people are conscious that the men who are bringing her are deeply religious men. And if you were to say, well, how are we to understand these men? How would we describe them? But they really are a warning to us about the danger of hypocrisy in religion. Religion is something which encourages hypocrisy. A hypocrite is somebody who pretends to be something that they're not. They have an outward appearance, they have an outward veneer, but inside it's not really like that. Jesus said on one occasion about the Pharisees that they wipe the outside of the cup, but they don't wipe the inside of the cup. They dealt with outward observance, but they didn't really address the needs of their hearts. And so although the people didn't recognize it, Jesus did, that these men were not what they seemed to be. And hence his challenge, if any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to cast a stone at her. The people probably would have thought, because they were so religious, that they didn't have the kinds of sins that ordinary people had. But they did. Every one of us struggles with a sinful heart. But here's the danger of hypocrisy. Having a religion which is simply outward. It's all to do with the things we do, with the observances, with praying. For instance, the Pharisees prayed 18 times every day. They fasted 2 whole days every week. They gave a tenth of everything that passed through their hands, money and goods and even herbs. They would weigh out and separate a tenth out. But it was all external. Their heart wasn't touched. When they taught about the law, because they taught what the law said, people thought they kept the law. Because of their knowledge, people assumed that that knowledge had been translated into life-transforming power, but it hadn't been. We're told that the Pharisees were lovers of money. And they were proud. In one of the parables that Jesus told, the Pharisees thanked God that he was not like other men. And outward religion is very proud. And people tend to think they're better than everybody else because of the religious things that they do. And that was their hypocrisy. That was their pretense. So that when those who'd gone to arrest Jesus came back and they hadn't arrested him, the Pharisees said this, has any of the rulers or of the Pharisees believed in him? No. But this mob that knows nothing of the law, there is a curse on them. You see the pride coming up. They despise this woman. They're not like her. But actually their hearts are as unclean as hers, and as unchanged and as untransformed as hers. And that's the danger, isn't it? The danger that we just stop at an outward religion. We're just going through the motions, really, and perhaps without the zeal that these men showed. And one of the things that is a characteristic of hypocrisy is that you gain credibility by pointing out the deficiencies of other people. You see, they stand and they point the finger at this woman. This woman, they said, was caught in the act of adultery. And behind the pointing finger, they are not what they seem to be. And that's the spirit of the hypocrite. It's pointing out other people's faults, other people's weaknesses, but never stopping to say, but what's it like with my heart? Is my heart right with God? You see something of the spirit of the Pharisee, the spirit of the person who's not real in the life of King David. You may be familiar with the events of his sin regarding Bathsheba, where he was unfaithful and he had a relationship with another man's wife, one of his best soldiers' wives. While this soldier was out serving with the army of Israel, David had Bathsheba brought to the palace, and he slept with her, and she conceived his child. And David does his best to cover his sin. He invites Uriah back, but that doesn't work. And so Uriah is sent back to the battlefield with the instruction he's be put in a dangerous place. And Uriah is killed. David does it to hide his own sin. And then after Uriah has died, he takes Bathsheba into his house and pretends that he is caring for one of his soldier's widows. And we're just simply told that the thing that David did displeased the Lord. He was displeased with what David did. He knew what David had done. But David carried on as if nothing had happened until God sent Nathan the prophet to confront David with what he had done. And David's hypocrisy comes out in how he responds to the story that Nathan tells him. Because as king, David had to give judgments in Israel. When something happened and a person suffered wrong, it was David's task to give a judgment and to make sure that it was put right. And so Nathan tells him a story about the rich man who had many animals. But when some visitors came, instead of taking one of his own animals, he went to a poor man and he took the only ewe lamb which this poor man had. And he gave that lamb to the visitors instead. When David heard that, he was incensed. And he said, the man who did that deserves to die. Now just think, he's taken one lamb and David is saying he deserves to die. But you see, if you looked at David then, you'd say, what a righteous man he is. How eager he is to see justice done for his people. How he is fighting for the cause of right. Because David said he deserves to die or to pay back four times what he took. And he was angry. But you see, he wasn't angry with himself. And Nathan says to him, you're the man. It isn't somebody taking a ewe lamb. It's somebody taking another man's wife. And that's you. And you see, that's the danger of the hypocrite. We cover our own failure by pointing out and magnifying and exaggerating the failures of others. And the tragic thing about these teachers of the law and Pharisees is not only that they pretended to be something that they were not, but their hypocrisy led them to hate Jesus, because Jesus exposed their real condition. And it's a strange thing that sometimes religious people will not come to Jesus because they want to hold on to their pretense of religion rather than to acknowledge their need and to acknowledge that it isn't a case of not being like other people, but that actually we are like other people. And Paul could say that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, and then he added this, of whom I am the chief. And so these men are a warning to us of pretense, hypocrisy, unreality, just living it out but not knowing the reality of it in our hearts. I wonder if you know the reality of God's work in your heart. Do you know your sin and your failure? And do you look at other people and say, well, you know, I'm like them. There's no difference. People outside, there but for the grace of God, go I. But what about the woman? If these men were a warning about hypocrisy, how would you describe her? Well, she's a picture of guilt. Guilt. She's been caught. Probably as the sun was rising, they broke in on one of these little shelters and they caught her. And they took her, just as she was, without, it seems, any concern for her modesty. And they brought her into the city. And then they brought her into the temple. And then they pushed through this great crowd of people who were around Jesus, listening to him teaching. And they pushed her through the crowd and brought her right before Jesus. And then in front of everybody, they said, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What do you say?" And so they announced to the world what she had done. And she's a picture of guilt. Perhaps there were some people who felt sorry for her as they saw her there and as they heard these men telling the world the sin of which she was guilty, a sin that was a shameful sin, a sin that everybody in Israel disapproved of. And it wasn't that somebody had told them that she had committed the sin. They had caught her in the very act. They were witnesses to her sin. And she must have looked down to the floor. She couldn't lift up and face anybody face to face. And she might have wished that the earth would just open up and swallow her, because she felt so overwhelmed with her guilt. And it seems as if there is no hope whatever for her. You see, as she listens to them saying that in the law Moses has commanded us to stone such women, I doubt if she was saying, "Well, they don't do that anymore, so that won't happen to me. I'll somehow get off with this and get away again back to the privacy of my own community and I'll be able to forget what had happened." In a sense, I think she was facing the consequences of her sin. You see, often we don't think about the consequences of our actions. Because God's judgment is in the future, we sin, we break his commands, and we don't tend to think of what one day we will have to face, the consequences of sin. Like somebody who's spending money on their bank account, and it's only when the statement arrives that they realize how much they've spent. They never thought about it. They bought this, they bought that. But all the time, the account was increasing. And sometimes there's no money to pay. And this woman is thinking, "Well, I met this man." Perhaps she knew him before. She was aware of him. And there was this moment of temptation. She could have said no. She could have said, "No, I won't do that. I'm married to somebody else and I won't do it, even though we're in a strange place, even though it's dark and nobody will see us. I won't do it." But there's something attractive about temptation. And she gave way to that temptation. And perhaps she thought, "Nobody will know. And we'll go our way before the light fully rises. And it'll be okay." But it wasn't. She was caught. She was dragged into the presence of Jesus. And the accusation was trumpeted before the crowd. And now she thinks, "Well, maybe these men who are so zealous, they'll actually take me out and put me to death today. And I'll die today because of what I have done." That was what they were saying. "Moses told us to do it." And it seemed they were ready to do it. And one of the issues for her was this, that because they had caught her in the act, because they knew what she had done, her conscience was agreeing with what they said. You know, I've heard sometimes people say, "Well, when I stand before God, I will say," and I don't think you will. Because when we stand before God, we're told every mouth will be silent. Because our conscience will either accuse us or excuse us in that day when we stand before him. And this day, her conscience accuses her. Her conscience says, "They're right. You did it. And you deserve to be punished." There was no possibility of putting a defense. Whenever we are overwhelmed with a sense of guilt, there's that feeling of helplessness. There's nothing that we can do, because what is being said is right. We did do it, and there's no excuse, and we must now suffer the consequences. And here she is, and she can't change the situation. And there's a song, isn't there, a periodically popular yesterday. And it says something like this: I said something wrong, and now I long for yesterday. A relationship has been spoilt because of a word that has been spoken. And I wish I could go back to yesterday. I wish I could go back to when it hadn't happened. And she wished that she could go back to this time yesterday, because yesterday it hadn't happened, but now it has. And she can't change it. And she can't deny it. And what they're saying is absolutely true. And there are all these accusers around us. We have a hymn by John Newton which says, "Be thou my shield and hiding place, that sheltered near thy side, I may my fierce accuser face and tell him, you have died." But she didn't know that then. There was no one to face her accusers. And perhaps what made it worst of all was she was standing in the presence of Jesus. I'm sure lots of the people going up to the feast were hoping that they'd see him. Perhaps they'd see him perform a great miracle, or they'd listen to him teaching. And if this was no ordinary feast, they knew he would be there, and they wanted to see him and perhaps just be in the crowd and see him at a distance. And this woman may well have been one of those hoping to see Jesus, because we can have strange mixtures of feelings, struggling with sin on the one hand and yet wanting to know more of God on the other, and the two things running side by side. Well, she sees Jesus. He's there, right in front of her. She couldn't be closer. And yet somehow he seems so far away. He seems unreachable. Because why would he be interested in her now that he knows what she is like? Do you see the difference between this woman and the Pharisees and the teachers of the law? They feel that what they are doing can pull the wool over his eyes, but it doesn't. She feels that what she is forever disqualifies her from his care and from his love. But the opposite is the case. He came not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. This man welcomes sinners, and he eats with them. And of course, that's why they brought her. Because he knows, they know that he wants to help people like her. And they want to make it impossible for him to help her. But you see, God didn't send his son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. And so here she is in her guilt. And if you've ever experienced guilt, you know how the fierce accuser says to you, "Well, that's it, isn't it? God won't be interested in you. Now he knows what sort of person you are. That's the end. There's no hope for you. He doesn't accept people like you." And she feels that. So near. And yet so far. So unreachable. And as they're asking this question, he's not saying anything. And he's writing on the ground. And they keep asking him, "What do you say? What do you say?" And here she is, overwhelmed with her guilt. And they seem so righteous. So what about him? How would you describe him? Well, he's pure. He's absolutely pure. There's no sin in him. No sinful nature. No sinful acts in thought, in word, in deed. He's absolutely pure. But he's also compassionate. It's a compassionate purity. We sang a hymn this morning, "Jesus, thou art all compassion, pure, unbounded love thou art. Visit us with thy salvation. Enter every trembling heart." This woman is trembling. She's overwhelmed with her guilt. But the one before whom she stands is all compassion. And he's pure. Isn't that a lovely phrase? Unbounded love. Love without limits. Love without bounds. And he is angry at them. When he stoops down and he refused to speak at first, he's grieved. He's grieved that one group of sinners can accuse another group of sinners, as if they don't need forgiveness too. And he's come to save people like this woman. He's come to bring God's grace to them. And so he just simply says, if any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. You see, in the Old Testament, the person who was witness to the crime would be the one who would start the execution if it was stoning. They would cast the first stone. So he said to these men, well, if you're without sin, then let the stoning begin. Now, what is he saying when if any one of you is without sin? Is he saying, well, this woman has broken one of the Ten Commandments, a major moral principle. But if any of you have perhaps just occasionally broken some minor law, some minor rule, I don't think he's saying that. I think he's saying to these men, if any of you is really as pure in your heart as you pretend to be, then you start the stoning. He knows that no temptation has come to us that is not common to every man. None of us is free from temptation to any and every sin that may come. And he's challenging them at that level. He's not just saying you've broken a few minor rules, perhaps. He's saying you have a struggle with your sinful nature, just like every other human being and just like this woman. And you see, when Jesus spoke, people knew that he knew them. He knew their hearts. And you couldn't pretend before him. And so do you see the picture? There's a crowd of people. And then there's these men. And they're pointing the finger at the woman. And then there's Jesus. And after he said those words, Jesus stoops down again. And he writes on the ground. We don't know what he wrote. And at this, those who heard began to go away. One at a time, the older ones first. I think the Gospels are amazing in the details that they give us. You see it, they're accusing. What do you say? What do you say? We caught her in the act of adultery. If any of you is without sin, let him be the first to cast a stone at her. And they think on what he said. Perhaps they look at each other. And then this man turns around and goes away. And the man standing next to him thinks, oh, he's gone. And then he goes. He goes. He goes. And in the end, they've all gone. They've all disappeared. They're no longer her accusers. And John tells us that it was the older ones who went first. Isn't that amazing? You know, we have the idea, don't we, as you get older, you somehow don't have such a struggle with sin. That somehow the grayer your hair gets or the less hair you have, somehow it's easier to live a godly life. But it isn't. We struggle with sin all our lives. And the longer we live and the older we get, the more we're conscious of our failure to do the very things that we promise to do and hope to do. And it's the young guys who think they can face him up. But one after one they go. Isn't that a wonderful picture? Think of all our accusers, the law, God's law. The people who know us, who know all about us and remember the things that we've done. Our own conscience that tells us that we're guilty. And Jesus breaks down every one of them and sends them away. Because in the end, there's just her and him. And that's the point we've got to come to, isn't it? Just me and him. You and him. Because the only thing that matters in the end is what he says. It's not what they say. Not even what I think or you think. It's what he says. Because he is the one who gives the final verdict. He is the one who speaks now and who will one day judge the world in righteousness. Because there is one, you see, who is without sin, and it's him. There is one who has the right to cast the stone, and it's him. And when he looks up, he says to the woman, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And in utter amazement, she says, "No one, sir." She can't believe it. They've gone. But there's still him. And then he says to her these amazing words, "Neither do I condemn you. Go now and leave your life of sin." Isn't that amazing? You know, do you sometimes tremble at the thought of standing in the presence of God? You know, people who face a criminal trial will come to that point where the jury have gone out and then they've come back and they say they've reached a verdict. And the question is, have you found the defendant guilty or not guilty? And on the words that the foreman of the jury speaks hangs so much. Guilty. Well, there are consequences to face. Not guilty. You can go free. And what Jesus says to this woman is, go free. No condemnation. It's an amazing thing. To know no she deserves to be condemned, but he came not to condemn, but to save. And he says to her, you can begin again. Your sins, which are many, have been forgiven. And you can go and start a new life. Have you ever heard God saying that to you in Jesus? As you felt no hope, you felt overwhelmed by your sinfulness. You felt that you deserve nothing from him. You'd sinned willfully, rebelliously. You knew it was wrong, but you did it. You did it again and again and again. You did it as a Christian. And you think to yourself, how could I have done that as a Christian? And you stand before him and you ask for his forgiveness. And he says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. It's that wonderful hymn, isn't there, of Wesley's. No condemnation. Now I dread. Jesus, and all in him is mine. Alive in him, my living head. And aren't these amazing words? And clothed in righteousness divine. Bold, I approach the eternal throne and claim the crown through Christ my own. You see, he can say to her, no condemnation, because he will be condemned. He will stand in her place. He will pay for that sin of adultery which she committed. And she will be as white as snow. And God will remove her sin as far from her as the east is from the west, and he will remember it no more, because his son will pay the price of that sin. Such is the love of God for us in Jesus Christ. His compassionate purity brought him into this world to live a pure life and then to be treated as a sinner and to die on the cross for our sins, that we might hear him say to us, neither do I condemn you. Go and leave your life of sin. Go and sin no more. Isn't that wonderful? Have you heard God saying that to you? No condemnation, no guilt, nothing to fear, because Jesus died for you. As I close, let's just go back a moment to the night when she was there with a man and they were together. And then the Pharisees and teachers of the law came. They broke in upon them. And they took her, but they didn't take him. That tells us something about them too. You see, they were men, and women were of little consequence in that world. Either the man was too strong and he ran away into the darkness. Or perhaps they said to him, we don't want you, you can go, we'll just take her. And as she was led away, she thought to herself, this is the worst day of my life. And perhaps the man ran and then he stopped and he watched her being taken away. And he said, oh, I feel so sorry for her. But this is my lucky day. I nearly got caught, but I got away with it. How wrong could he be? It wasn't the lucky day for him, it was the worst day of his life, because he never came to Jesus. And yet, you know, every Sunday there are people who listen to the message of the gospel, they listen to the message of forgiveness through Jesus Christ, and they say, I want to be free to carry on living the way I am. And they go out, and they're just the same. And it's always a dark day when that happens. It's another opportunity missed. And what we need to do is to come to him now and to acknowledge our sin and to find his forgiveness. And she said, it's the worst day of my life, it's the end. But actually it wasn't. It was the beginning, a new beginning. It was a chance to start again, to be forgiven, for the slate to be wiped clean, and to begin to live a life of love and thankfulness to the one who had loved her and had given himself for her. Have you had such a day? It started off, it seemed the worst day, and yet it brought you to Jesus, and you experienced his love, and everything changed, and nothing has been the same ever since. Won't you come to him, and won't you experience the same grace that this lady experienced, and begin a new life as she began a new life that day? Let's sing together our closing hymn. It's number 569. Today, thy mercy calls us to wash away our sin, however great our trespass, whatever we have been, however long from mercy our hearts have turned away. Thy blood, O Christ, can cleanse us and make us pure today. 569.